Hey, good morning. How are we? Good. If you have your Bibles, why don't you grab them? We are going to a chipper little book in the middle of the Old Testament, Ecclesiastes. And so if you've got it, flip there. Right before we get started, I want to thank Watermark for having me and particularly for giving me the third day 10 a.m. slot, which is the perfect time for a little bit of exegetical Bible study. So I will not take it personal if you look a little tired on me or if you fall asleep on me. That'll be between you and God and whether or not you fear his ability to destroy you. So I'll leave it at that and go from there. Let me pray, and then we'll get started wrestling through Solomon's lamenting of the universe. So let me pray. Father, I thank you for these men and women, and I thank you for a chance to come together. And I just confess that maybe it's because I'm tired because of yesterday or the drive-in last night, but thank you for the band and thank you for that song. And why should we gain from your reward? And what in the world's going on that we have become your treasure? And so I just thank you and praise you that in you is life and rest and peace and the fullness of all things. And we find ourselves as men and women here this morning caught up in something so much bigger than we can fathom, caught up in something so much bigger than we can comprehend. And so we ask this morning that in your wisdom and in your infinite mercy, you would expand our ability to comprehend and thus increase worship. And so will you stir our affections and our hearts towards you, and will you make the peripheral things in our lives just that, peripheral, and will you give us the vision to see what is true and right and real, and let everything else grow dim, and that's going to take you, because that can't be sung into being, and that can't be preached into being, and that can't be community into being. You've got to do something in us. You've got to take some things that have gone wrong in us, and you've got to right them. And so we are really desperate to hear from you and to experience you and see you and feel you and know you and taste you and be near to you. You are the treasure. You are the goal. You are what we need. And so, God, I just ask for your help. These are impossible things for men to communicate, impossible things to get across to the soul. I think the mind grabs them kind of easily sometimes, but the soul grabbing them, that's something that only your Holy Spirit can do. So just in desperation, I don't want to waste my time this morning. I don't want to waste their time this morning talking about you. I want you to be here and to stir in us affection for you and for each other and for the kingdom. And so help. I think that's just, if I shorten this prayer, it'd just say help. And it's for your beautiful name, I pray. Amen. All right, Ecclesiastes, I've been asked to talk to you about relationships, but I'm going to go about it a little bit different way because historically I can't stand the Christianese that surrounds relationships, particularly dating relationships. I think the wildly popular one is the one that all the married people tell you, and that's when they finally quit looking, they finally found someone, right? Well, man, I never quit looking. I was hunting, dog, all right? I mean, I was out there finding, all right? I am a sovereignty of God guy, but also believe in progressive sanctification. So I was kind of working my angles and trusting the sovereignty of God to work it out. So I've never been the one that's just like, you know what you ought to do? Nothing. Sit back, let it go. It'll come to you. That is kind of not, anyway, not, neither here nor there. So what I do want to do with you today is kind of take you and walk you through some of Solomon's experiences and some of what Solomon saw in life. Because I think if we can get into our heads the things Solomon's trying to unpack for us, then those things will kind of take care of themselves. So we'll get to relationships, but it's going to kind of be on the backside of this. And we've got a lot to do and not a lot of time to do it. So if you don't know about the book of Ecclesiastes, Ecclesiastes is an experiment done by King Solomon. King Solomon, who is smarter than you, he is wealthier than you, he is more powerful than you, and he is better looking than you, and there is nothing you can do about it. He has outdone you in every way, in every endeavor that you will ever take. No matter how successful you are, you will always be junior varsity, all right? And so he uses his wealth, his power, his prestige, his kingship, all right, to experiment with life and find out if there really is anything worth having or worth experiencing. And so what we're going to do is we're going to walk through his pursuit this morning, and then on the back side of it, he's going to kind of tell us some things that will enlighten us not only for all pursuits, but particularly your pursuit for relationships. All right, so let's go. Ecclesiastes chapter 2. We'll start in verse 1. And you'll kind of see the progression of pursuits here that has befallen most of us, actually. All right. And so Ecclesiastes chapter 2, we're going to do the entire chapter. We're just going to talk a little bit or read a little bit, talk a little bit, read a little bit, talk a little bit, read, talk, read, talk, read, talk, read, 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 talk. And then we'll be done. All right. So Ecclesiastes chapter 2, starting in verse 1, here's how it starts. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? So I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. So Solomon goes, okay, I want to see if anything's worth anything. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to check out pleasure. I'm going to check out whether or not there's anything lasting or anything enduring or anything of intrinsic value within pleasure. And so what he begins to do is, honestly, if you go back and read 1 Kings, he begins to party, all right? Now, get out of your head that kegger in college or your little 4th of July soiree, because Solomon, remember, is better than you. He is beyond you, and he is greater than you, okay? What Solomon began to do was every night of the week, all right, for nearly a decade, he threw these massive, massive, massive parties at his place, all right? And what we find, if you'll go back, and I don't have time this morning, but if you'll go back in 1 Kings and read about it, you'll find out just what was on the menu for one day of these parties. And it was something, I mean, just obscene. It was like 400 heads of cattle. It was like 1,000 gazelles. I mean, it's estimated that just what was on the menu could feed up to 15,000 people, all right? So every night of the week, he's got 15,000 people at his house drinking wine, eating good food. He's bringing in comedians, all right? He's bringing in Dave Chappelle, a clean Dave Chappelle. He's bringing in the redneck guys that are so popular right now. Personally, don't get it, but all right. Bringing in those guys. He's bringing in comedians. He's bringing in bands, all right? He didn't bring in DJs. He's bringing in bands, all right? He is celebrating like the world has never seen, and he's doing it night after night after night after night after night after night after night. Are you following me? All right, because it's 10 years long. I don't have that kind of time, all right? So he is going to let the thing build progressively. So it didn't start out that big. It started out kind of your average college party. And he's like, you know what? After a couple weeks of that, he's like, this isn't really working for me anymore. I'm not getting the same kind of high off of this. Let's make it bigger. Let's make it so they invite more people, get more cakes, more bottles of wine, another couple cows, all right? And he does that for a couple of months, and then it's not satisfying anymore. It's not as satisfying. So he goes, you know what? Let's make it bigger. And this progresses, and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. He's shutting down vineyards, all right? It's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And finally, it cannot get any bigger. All right. Finally, it's the biggest party you can throw, as much wine as you can get, as many cows as you can kill. The party and the high cannot get any bigger. And so he's on this kind of drive for several years, and then finally gets tired of waking up in the back of an El Camino with a new tattoo and decides to move on from the party scene and goes, you know what? Okay, maybe partying, maybe pleasure, maybe this life isn't fulfilling, maybe I got to make something of myself. Maybe what I need to do is leave a legacy, you know? Maybe what I need to do is leave something that'll live on after me, and then maybe I'll find some satisfaction. So he moves on from these epic parties to what's next. All right, look at what's next in chapter 2. There we go, verse 4. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks, and I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. And I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. So Solomon moves on from the party scene and he goes, okay, this isn't fulfilling. This doesn't bring any lasting pleasure. I know it will. I'm going to make something of myself. And he begins to build houses, all right? He builds houses not only for himself, but for his wives, which is a subject we'll get onto here in a minute, all right? And so he builds not just your normal day house, because remember, he's better than you, all right? So it takes him 14 years and nearly 150,000 men to build his house, all right? On top of that, he plants forests and vineyards and national parks, all right? So I know that you planted those two crepe myrtles in front of your little duplex, and you're really proud of that, all right? But Solomon's going, unless your little garden has the word national in front of it, junior varsity, all right? Varsity. Junior varsity, all right? You've got a crepe myrtle. I planted vineyards, all right? You put in Augustine grass. I made a forest, all right? I made a forest. Not only did I make a forest, but then I created an irrigation system in which to water the forest, all right? So I'm glad your new house has a sprinkler system, all right? But I have gone beyond you. I have built so much so that to this day, if you go to Israel, keep your head down. And that's A. And then B, if you'll head out west of Jerusalem, that was subtly brilliant. Most of you missed it. But the if you head out west of Jerusalem, you will find these craters in the earth. You know what they're called? The Pools of Solomon. They were the pools that he dug up and built to water the forests. Yeah. I mean, so here we are thousands of years later in Solomon's Mark. It's still there. And so then he goes, okay, I can't build anything else. I mean, how do you top a forest? I mean, where do you move on to from that? So I've done a forest and I've done my house and I've done the temple. I've built houses for all my wives, by the way, all 700 of them. More on that later. I have done vineyards. I have done that. Okay, what else do you build? I mean, there's really nothing else to build. I've built it all. I'm still kind of bored. So he moves on. He goes, I know what I'm going to do. All right, so the party scene got old. I couldn't get any bigger with that, and it didn't really satisfy me for any extended period of time. And then I built all this junk, and I'm looking around. And I like it, and it's nice, but in the end, it's, I'm kind of bored. There's nothing else to build. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to do nothing. I'm going to sit back. And I'm just going to enjoy my immense wealth. So look at this. Look at what he does next. Verse 7. So I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. And I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delights of the pleasure of man. So Solomon goes, okay, I'm partying and I'm trying pleasure, and that's not doing anything for me. When in the end, I can't get any bigger. I can't sustain this kind of joy and this high. So then I went and trying to make something of myself and leave a legacy and build and be successful. And I've done that, and it hasn't done anything to kind of fill this thing up in me. And so here's what I'm going to do. Nothing. So I'm going to sleep in. I'm going to get a massage. I'm going to have other people cook my food. I'm going to have somebody else chew my food. I'm going to get a massage in the afternoon. Then I'm going to go to my ranch, and then I'm going to get up from my ranch. I'm just going to count my money. All right. And then I'm going to take my chariot with 22-inch spinners. I'm going to take it out on, I'm just going to enjoy my wealth. And then here's the other thing, and this is so big because we're such an overtly sexual society, all right? And we've so removed the heart out of sex that all that's left is technique, which is why you can't look at a magazine and then try to teach you sexual technique as if technique is going to fill the void in your life. But that's neither here nor there. I don't have time. Let's go now. Solomon has 700 wives and 300 concubines. Look at me. Uninhibited sexuality belongs to Solomon. I mean, he doesn't go, I think I'd like to be with the blonde. He's got blondes, a couple hundred of them. I think I'd like to be with the brunette. I think I would like this shape. I think I would like, no, he's got it. 1,000 women at his beck and call. All right, so you've got a guy who's partied beyond anything you can fathom. You've got a guy who has been more successful than you and all of your friends combined will ever be able to be. Told you, this is a chipper book. You've got a guy who has accomplished more in his short life than you and I will. You've got a guy who accumulated so much wealth that for the last portion of his life, he did nothing. You've got a guy that has in his hands, look at me, everything. Everything you're currently consciously or subconsciously pursuing. And look at what he's going to say. Look at what's next. There are some perks to this life. All right, look at verse 9. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Just a little, you know, if you're throwing a party and feeding 15,000 people every night, you're popular. All right. Also, my wisdom remained with me. And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep it from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for my toil. And so I want you to hear something, because sometimes in church, pastors and preachers say really dumb things that aren't true. And one of the things is a life like this isn't pleasing, you know? It's like sex with women and partying. Who wants that? You know, and half the crowd's like, well, I don't want that. Eh? Is that rhetorical? All right. Am I supposed to answer that? Like there's no pleasure in that and there's no joy in that. But Solomon just said, no, listen, I did that. I did the party scene and I did the build out scene and I did the women's scene and I had a lot of money and it was nice. And it was nice, but that's where it ended. That's, you know, there was a little bit of pleasure there and it was there for a moment and then it was gone. Like I would get a new wife and it would be so awesome and so great. But you know, 4 months later, it kind of lost its lust. So, you know, I had to go get another one. And then I had to go get another one. And then after 700 times, I started thinking to myself that maybe this isn't going to work. And so I went with concubines and said, you know what? All these building houses for wives, it's getting old, man. I'm just going to go with concubines. And then he gets one of those. And 4 months later, he's like, no, I don't know. So for, you know, 200, he's not a quick learner. God bless him. You know, 300 concubines later, he's like, all right, this isn't. There's definitely this piece of pleasure in the acquisition of stuff, and there's definitely this pleasure in relationships and sex, and there's definitely this pleasure in party. There's definitely this pleasure in these things, but in the end, they do nothing to fill the thing that's so hungry in us to be filled. Yeah, look, he'll say it better than I will. All right, look at verse 11. Then I considered all that my hands had done, and the toil I had expended in doing it. And behold, all was what? Vanity. That's the word useless. It's the word useless in the Hebrew. By the way, it's in this book 32 times. All was useless and a striving after wind. And there was nothing to be gained under the sun. Here's why I think you have to pay attention to the next 20 minutes here. The reason why you and I are in some danger that Solomon is not in is because Solomon had the resource to realize all his dreams and find out in the end, after he realized all his dreams, that they weren't enough to satisfy him. The trouble you and I are in is that we don't have these kind of resources, so we can perpetually be living in a mythical future that's going to satisfy us, despite the fact that, well, here's how it works. When we were in college, we kind of had this this kind of 10-year map out in our head. Now, if you're type A, you actually mapped it out in your Franklin Covey planner, all right? But for most of us, we didn't go A1, A2, B1, all right, and down the list. We didn't do that. We just, in our mind, said, you know, in 10 years, here's kind of what I see my life being. I would like to maybe be married. I'd like to have a successful job. I'd like to maybe be in a house. I'd like to have a car. I'd like to have, and we kind of said, these are the things that are required to make me happy. Now, chances are that here 10 years later, you've acquired 90% of those things, but in reality, you've already started working a new 10-year list. You've already gained those things, and they've done nothing to quell the storm, and so now you're working another 10-year list. And the problem for most of us, because we're not going to have this kind of wealth, and we're not going to have this kind of power, and it's illegal to have this many wives, all right? You're not going to be able to experiment to the extent that Solomon did, and so if you're not careful, you're going to always be working a new 10-year plan and never find out what you're really here for. It can be devastating. Can be devastating. So that's why I think we have to listen to our boy here, man. We've got to listen to him, because if you're not careful, you're going to be working this perpetual list that never satisfies. And since you don't have the kind of wealth and don't have the kind of power, you'll always be able to think of this. Oh, it's just this. Okay, if I could just get to this. Well, the thing about Solomon is he got there. He exhausted it. I can't have any more sex. I can't get any more money. I can't throw any more bigger parties. I can't have any more friends. I can't. All right. So he did it. He beat us there. And that's why I'm telling you, he's better than you. He's already got there. So we need to listen to him. We need to listen to him. If not, we're going to spend the rest of our lives on the treadmill. You know what I'm saying? Sweating to death, but not going anywhere. Getting exhausted, but in the end, you didn't go anywhere. All right. So let's see if there's... Let's find some hope here. Let's find some hope here. It's still about 15 minutes away, but it's here. So, all right. Look at verse 12. He's going to start giving us advice now. So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? All right. Listen to what he says. Only what has already been done. That's him saying, okay, there's nothing you could ever do that I haven't already beat you to. All right. There's nothing you could do that I couldn't come along and say, yeah, tried it. This is how it ends. All right. Solomon will ruin the end of every little movie in your mind. Are you tracking with me? He will ruin the end of every little movie, every little romantic thought, every little goal, every little hope, every little. This is not a guy you want to go to dinner with. All right. It's not a guy you want to hang out with. I don't even like him, and I'm preaching him. All right. So let's go. Verse 13. Then I saw, here's where he starts with the advice. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Here's what he's going to say. He's going, okay, since all of these things end badly, and most of you aren't going to be able to do the things that I was able to do to come to these conclusions, here's some advice I would give you. Why don't you pay attention to the results of your pursuits? All right? Why don't you pay attention to what your life is producing in the deep parts of the soul? Like, okay, so you're going, oh, if I get this job, this will quiet. Okay, you got the job. Did it work? I mean, Solomon is saying here, the question that should dominate our thinking is this working for me? Are these relationships working for me? Is this job working for me? That it is better to live life with your eyes open than with your eyes closed. Now, I've never found anybody who wants to argue that, all right? Nobody thinks it's smarter to close your eyes and run through a dark room than to keep your eyes open, turn the lights on, and pay attention to what your life is producing. The things that are promised to you in Scripture, are you finding those things as you're living life? What are the results of the things that you're pursuing? Is it working? So he's going to say, hey, listen, you're going to have to keep your eyes open, man. You're going to have to pay attention to your heart. I was out in San Diego about 3 weeks ago wondering why I lived in Texas. And while I was out there, it was me and a bunch of other guys. I actually grew up on the West Coast, born in Seattle, and then was in San Francisco for a while. And then God sent me here. So it's a great state. A little weird for me, all right? But it's a great state. A lot of strange pride here, but that's neither here nor there. I was out there and watching these guys surf down in San Diego, and I was with some guys from Texas, and so we were talking, hey, do you surf? You know, we're a bunch of posers, and like, yeah, I tried it once, man. And here's something that I noticed, like when you're surfing, if you make it all the way to the beach, there's usually some pain involved in that. I mean, if you just go with the flow and don't get off your board in time, you don't pay attention where you are, what ends up happening is you get slammed in this little thing called coral or the beach itself. So you don't want to, with your life, just get on the board and go, it'll end when it ends. I mean, you want to be paying attention, man. If you don't pay attention, things go bad for you. I'm going to try to be just real straight with you today. I mean, I'm pastor in a church. It creates a lot of concerns in me talking with guys who've been addicted to porn for 15 years and don't realize it's been 15 years. Or little girls have been hurting themselves, making themselves throw up or starving themselves to death and don't realize it's been going on since they were 14 and they're now 28. And this is not paying attention to what's going on in your life and being stuck in really, really, really broken cycles of living and not paying attention enough to see it. Instead, just letting the wind carry you could be devastating in the end. Could be devastating in the end. And then he goes, this is why I love Solomon. He's going to give you this little bit of advice and then tell you why it doesn't matter. All right. He's going to tell you, hey, pay attention. But in the end, who cares? Because you're going to die. All right. Look at this. Why? Look at him. This is why I love this guy. All right. This is why. Goodness sakes, man. When I'm done preaching this, I'm going to try to do Lamentations with you at 2 today. It'll be good. All right. Let's look at this. Let's look at this. The wise person has eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I perceived that the same events happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will also happen to me. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity. What's useless? Living wise. It's useless because you're going to die just like the moron. So who cares? All right. Look at what he says here. All right. And I said in my heart that this also is useless. For of the wise as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come, all will have long been forgotten. Can I show you just a really hard reality of life on this side of the loom? How many of you in here, and I want you to just raise your hands for me. How many of you in here can tell me the name of your great, great grandfather? 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. Okay. So outside of 10 to 11 of you, 60 years from now, no one remembers who you were, what you did, or where you were from. Selah. Chew on that a little bit. I'm just going to drink my water. Go ahead and think on that for a minute. 60 years from now, no one remembers who you are. Your grandchildren are not driving through Dallas going, Jesus, thank you for great, great grandma. Thank you for great, great grandfather who bestowed upon the next generation the wisdom that led me to you. They're not. You die and turn to dust just like all the morons. Solomon. Drink it deep. Drink it deep. All right, so he tells you, pay attention to the results of your pursuits, and then goes, but in the end you'll die. All right? Now, I promise you this would take a turn for the good. And that was it. So let's pray. No, let's go. Let me keep reading. I got to hurry up with you. Sorry. You're going to look at some despair now because Solomon's going, he's going, I've done all that I can do and I can't get this thing to shut up inside of me. Look at what happens. Verse 17. So I hated life because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity, all is useless and a striving after wind. First, he's going to be really grieved. And here's why he's grieved, because there's a diminishing amount of return for the pleasure he's seeking. The things that used to bring him pleasure, he's having to do more and more and more of it to create that same pleasure. And now he's topping everything out. So like we've already talked about, he can't get any bigger. He can't get any better. He can't get any more wives. He can't do anything else. And so now he's in this place where he really can't find pleasure anymore. He really can't find any satisfaction. And he's finding his heart grieved. And it's going to move on from being grieved to something else here. Look at verse 18. So I hated all my toil in which I toiled under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will be master of all of which I toiled and used my wisdom on under the sun. This also is vanity. He's saying here, and I think if you know some history, this will help you. I don't know how much you know about Israel, specifically Israel at this time, but after King Solomon dies, Israel is fractured. There's kind of a rebellion that occurs, and it's fractured into two, Judah and Israel. And then in the next, 70 years or so, both will cease to exist. And so Solomon he's getting older, and he's looking at his moron sons, and he's saying, I'm about to die, and these morons are going to destroy everything I have built, and there is nothing I can do about it. And so he has gone from being grieved to being immensely frustrated because he's learned these things and he's learned how to do life and he's built this kingdom and things are going well for Israel and he sees what's next behind him and he goes, we're in trouble and there's nothing I can do about it. And grieved turns to frustrated, turns to absolute despair. All right, look at this. Verse 20. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair. over all the toil of my labors under the sun, because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone else who did not toil for it. This also is useless and a great evil. There are these moments in history, we barely get to see him or touch him or taste him, that a young guy or a guy, and when I say young, I'm talking 40 or 50, acquires everything that he ever wanted to acquire early on. And then these weird things begin to happen to him, like they hole themselves up in a hotel for the last 20 years of their lives before they die. Or like, I'll give you an example of one that and this is just my opinion of what happened, but I was a big, 93, I graduated high school in 93, was supposed to graduate in 92, spent a little extra time in the eighth grade, but that's neither here nor there. So graduated in 93 and was a really big Nirvana fan, still am kind of a big Nirvana fan. That might be offensive to some of you, but I'm all right with that. And, my thing on music is just say something, man. If you'll say something, I'm with you. And, watching that last year of Kurt Cobain's life, I mean, you're talking about a guy who had accomplished everything he wanted to accomplish and couldn't silence the demons inside of him. And so you've got, I mean, what's he going to do to silence him? Is he going to buy another house? Is he going to make another platinum record? Is he going to? And so you're witnessing, I think, in Kurt Cobain, you're witnessing grief turn to frustration, turn to despair. I think that's what's happening. And there's more examples than just him. I mean, you can look all around and find these examples of people who get what they think they want and then have nowhere else to go. Now, he's finally going to ask the question that leads us to the good stuff. All right. So here we go. Look in verse 22. We're almost done. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night, his heart does not rest, and this also is vanity. Now, with two statements, Solomon's asking some questions here, all right? With these two statements, he's saying this. Is there any real hope then? Okay, so I've tried the party scene, I've tried the build scene, I've tried the resting in wealth scene. I've done all I know to kind of quiet these things inside of me and find fulfillment. Is there any real hope? Can there ever be any lasting joy, any lasting fulfillment, any place where the heart can finally drink deep and be satisfied? That's his question, and he moves to answer him, and he answers first by revealing the heart of man. Look at verse 24. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. All right, look right at me. How many of you speak another language? Any of you? Okay, good. There are some times when you speak another language that you'll try to translate something. There'll be like one or two words in your original language, but you try to bring it into English, or you try to bring it into Spanish, you try to bring it into Greek, you try to bring it into Hebrew, and one or two words just doesn't do it. There's some things happening in this text very similar to that, because the way it reads isn't really what it's saying. What he's saying in this text is that there is nothing, all right? There is nothing within a man or a woman to enable them to experience any kind of lasting enjoyment in food or drink or friends. Or there is nothing intrinsic inside of you, nothing inside of you that's going to enable you to experience enjoyment and fullness for any lengthy period of time. And you know how I'll prove it? I'll prove it with you. All right. We don't buy clothes because we need clothes. We buy clothes because we get bored and our lives become predictable. And in a rut, we get up and go buy clothes or some new gadget or some new toy or some new car, because it'll silence Solomon's conclusion that the world is in the end pretty worthless. Don't we? It ain't like you go buy clothes because yours disintegrated. And you don't go buy clothes because yours have a hole in them, because we buy clothes with holes in them now. All right, so we go and acquire. I mean, listen, and this needs to keep up because our whole economy is built off of this sin. We have got to continually buy trinkets and toys and put things around us that will numb us to the reality of the treadmill existence that we find ourselves in. And so we buy that new phone and we like it. It starts our car and makes coffee and it's as big as our watch. And we buy it and we love it. And then 4 months later, there's a newer commercial, a newer kind of vibe, a newer deal. And now all of a sudden we want that phone. And we don't go buy new cell phones because ours are busted. We go buy new cell phones because there's a cooler one. Am I a liar? I'm not a liar. You don't go buy clothes because you don't fit or because you just go because you're like, God, what are we going to do? I don't know. I'm bored. I know. We'll buy new clothes. And have you ever thought about how strange and weird it is that new stuff has a drug-like effect on you? Have you ever thought that? Have you ever thought that a new gadget, new toys, new cars, new clothes, they make you feel better? Have you ever thought through what's happening there? I mean, that a new cell phone makes you feel cool. So you're always checking your time on it instead of the watch when you're with the crew. Let me see what time it is. 7:14. So I just didn't know if you want to know what time it was. So it makes us feel better about ourselves. Here's why. Because there's nothing in you that's ever going to give you any lasting fulfillment. So you're always going to need more. And listen, look right at me. You know what? Just really sad as you start to really study people's lives. The majority of people all over the world have ascribed to this philosophy that what they need to make themselves happy is more of what they currently possess. It's just absolutely damning. What's finally going to make me happy? What's finally going to fill this void is more of what I already have. It's madness. It's madness. Nothing. Nothing in you. Nothing you could get. Nothing you could acquire. Nothing. Now be careful about this because some of you, man, you've got this picture in your head of when I get this, then it'll be done. And the big one, when you start walking with singles and doing college ministry is marriage. It's always marriage. When I find that significant other, when I find the mythical one that's right up there with the unicorn and the Oompa Loompa, all right? When I find the mythical one, when I finally find the one, then all that troubles me, if I could find that one, then the things that frustrate me or my issues would go away if I could just find someone to love me right. Wrong. You're wrong. And that's why we have to do so much marital counseling later on. Because you're wrong. Because you're not going to find a man that's going to fulfill you. And you're not going to find a woman who's going to be able to help you with your issues. If anything, marriage is one of the most helpless feelings in the world. Because your spouse will struggle. Your spouse will have this misfiring off spiritually. And there's nothing you can do. It doesn't matter how romantic you are, how sweet you are, how thoughtful you are, what you give. You are inadequate. Because what is wrong in the human spirit is eternal. And nothing temporal can fill that gap. We'll get to that at 2. We'll get to that at 2. There is nothing that's going to bring you fulfillment. There's nothing in you to allow you to experience it. And I know right now you're going, I thought you said we were getting to the good news. All right. Well, okay. He's going to answer. How do we do it then? All right. How does it happen? And then we'll talk about relationships here. There is nothing within a person that he should eat, drink, and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. Listen to this. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? Look at verse 26. For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. Okay, so look right at me. Look right at me. So lasting enjoyment and lasting fulfillment, according to Solomon, is a gift from Jesus. And the reason is that if Jesus is the pursuit, if Jesus is the treasure, then you have separated out stuff from satisfaction. And they're not the same thing anymore. All right? And so when Jesus is the pursuit, when Jesus is the ultimate, when Jesus is the goal, the pursuit, the treasure, then all of a sudden everything else is freed up to just be what it is. So now all of a sudden money isn't what satisfies me. Money is just what I have that was a gift to me from Jesus, so I can feel free to spend it or give it away or enjoy it because it doesn't make me or define me. And relationships all of a sudden can be enjoyed because relationships don't define us. They're a gift from the ultimate and then can be enjoyed in their proper context. Now, if you don't do this, now listen to me. Here's why I want to start talking to you about relationships. 99% of all conflict is birthed out of a misunderstanding of this. Look right at me. Because if you don't understand that in Christ and Christ alone is fulfillment and the ability to enjoy deeply all of God's gifts, then what you will do is expect that people and circumstances exist to make you happy. So then when you are not happy, you will look around your circle of people to figure out who is failing in terms of making you happy, and you will begin to assert blame and destroy relationships. And so here's what happens. A man wakes up and he's got a house and he's got a car and he's got a wife and kids and he's got a promotion and he makes good money and he's still not happy. And so what he begins to do is look around and go, you know what? They don't respect me at work. And if they would respect me at work more, then I'd be happy. And you know, if my wife would have more sex with me, then I would be happier. And so you know why I'm not happy? My wife and the people at work. That's what's wrong. And they begin to sabotage relationships because they think that people can satisfy them and make them happy. And it's an impossibility. So they start destroying stuff. They start destroying the relationships around them because they believe that people and circumstances exist to make them happy. And all the while, Solomon is screaming from Ecclesiastes that they're wrong. Oh, if my wife would just have more sex with me. Wrong. I've got 700 of them, and trust me, it's a freaking nightmare, all right? Trust me, that's not the answer. It's not the answer. Oh, if I could just get that promotion, if I could just get a bigger ad, they'd just respect me at work. If I could just be more successful. And Solomon goes, no, no, no. If I could just retire early, then I could have people serve me. If I could just take it easy, if I just wasn't so stressed, if I wasn't so busy. Wrong. You're wrong. Those things will not enable you to find lasting joy and fulfillment. They'll make you high for a minute and then they'll betray you. So you'll have to get more. 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 And eventually you'll run out of resources or you'll run out of friends. So I think the big question here then is, okay, what? He says that the one who pleases God, so I'm not talking about church folk here. That's not, you know, the one who pleases God, these are the ones that get these things. So what pleases God? That's the big question, you know. A lot of people have a really skewed view of God. What pleases God? I find that it's kind of a generational thing. Like every generation has this either spoken or unspoken list of what supposedly pleases God. Like I'm 32 when I was in college. If you were a Christian guy in college, you had to play the acoustic guitar, man. If you were not playing the acoustic guitar and listening to Shane Bernard, you could not be saved, all right? I mean, people would gasp, all right? You, what? What? Huh, what? No, it's G, C, and D, and you better learn it, all right? And because every worship song was, never mind, I don't have time, all right? And then now, you know, they're now, I mean, if you look at, you know, 40-year-olds, it's that, you know, you're a Republican and you got an ictus on your car and you don't see rated R movies unless they're about Jesus. And so this is the list for 30 and 40-year-olds. And so there's this spoken or unspoken list of what pleases God. But listen, in the end, Those things are awash. They're peripheral. And in fact, you can tell what a person believes about God by what they think pleases God. God's pretty simple on what pleases him. Here's what he says pleases me. Faith. Faith pleases me. But here's where we get in trouble, right? Faith is an ambiguous church word, isn't it? And I mean, isn't this the time where I go, have more faith? And then I pray and we're like, yeah, faith. And then we head out and we don't have a freaking clue what that means or what that looks like or what you do with that. And then over coffee sometime this week, somebody's gonna be like, I'm struggling right now. And we're gonna go, you know, you need. Solomon says you lack faith, buddy. Ecclesiastes, read it, all right? And then start regurgitating trash that we heard at church that does nobody any good. Okay, so let's talk faith. Faith is, I mean, you've got the great definition of faith in Hebrews, but let me say this because I think we'll grab this easy. Faith is just believing that God is here, that he's here, and that everything in your life has come from his hand. Let me try to help here with what Christianity looks like at its simplest level. So when I get saved a little bit later, almost 18, they start unpacking the rules for me, all right? We're not allowed to cuss anymore unless we're in traffic, no one can hear us. You're not allowed to drink anymore because the wine that Jesus made in the New Testament wasn't fermented and couldn't make anybody drunk. Which is why it leads to debauchery, because grape juice will turn a party out. Not allowed to drink, not allowed to cuss. We're not allowed. We've got to tuck in our shirts. You've got to part your hair a certain way. You've got to learn Christianese, which is a really interesting language. And you've got to pick it up. And this is what life has to look like. This is what, and they build these parameters around it. And then they start teaching this thing called quiet time, which really sounds a lot more like punishment than it does communing with God. Oh, it's time for your quiet time. Go sit in the corner and think about the bad things you've done. And so I find that I'm not really wired that way. And so I'm struggling early on. Let me maybe try to help in a different way. To follow Jesus is a really kind of individual, beautiful thing. And he's wired us differently. And so for anybody to stand up and say, this is exactly what it looks like for you, is a really dangerous, dangerous thing. Because if you've ever had that moment where somebody said, here's the four things you have to do to commune with God, and you've done those four things and God feels far from you, you find your heart in a lot of despair because you think either maybe you're not saved or this thing's just not working for you. You tracking on that? Like there's no sermons that'll make me more angry than like the 8 ways to remove doubt. Because what do you do when you do those 8 things and doubt still remains? Well, now you got more doubt than you did before you friggin' heard the sermon. Okay, so let me make it like this so we can end today, hopefully, with you pursuing Jesus as the goal. As individuals, God's wired us in certain ways, specific ways, that when we're a part of certain things, they stir our affections for him. Like when we're around them, or when we're a part of them, or when we're doing those things, they stir our hearts towards Jesus for whatever reason. And we're all wired differently. So what stirs your affections might not be what stirs my affections. What I know is for all of us, it involves scripture and it involves some kind of praying. But outside of that, man, it looks crazy different. I'll explain what I mean. At my college roommate's dad died of cancer when we were seniors in college. And full military funeral, he'd won the Medal of Honor in Vietnam, and Marines were out there shooting 21 gun salute. And afterwards, I just walked around the graveyard for a while. And you know what I found while I was out there? I found that some guys die when they're my age. You want to hear something crazy? I'd never thought of that before. And there was something in that moment. There was something in that moment when I looked at a tombstone with a guy who was my age that it began to remind me that I'm temporary and began to push me into Jesus. And so you know what stirs? You know what some of the things that stir my affections for Jesus? Graveyards. And so you know what? Sometimes I go to the grave. I mean, I don't take my wife there on a date or anything, all right? But I go. I take my journal. I take my Bible. I walk around the graveyard until I can find somebody who died the year I'm in. So this year when I go to the graveyard, I find somebody who's 32 and I wonder about his life. And I wonder if he had family. I wonder if he had 2 kids like I have 2 kids. I wonder if he had a wife. I wonder if he had hopes and dreams. I wonder. And there's something about that that'll sink me back up. There's something about the early morning and the smell of coffee. Like, we have a deck on the back of our house. It's made of wood. And no matter, even in July when it's 170, it's 6 a.m., the deck's cool. Like, the deck's cool. And there's something about getting a cup of coffee and sitting on the back porch that stirs my affections for Jesus. There's something about good music, heart-stirring music. And you know what's funny? Sometimes for me, they're not even Christian bands. Like, I'm a huge fan of the Album Leaf, huge fan. I mean, some of those guys that create that stuff, man, it just stirs in me an affection for the things of God. And so these are just some. I could go on and on and on with things that stir my affections. Books. I'm just an avid reader. And these things stir my affections for Jesus. But how sinful would it be for me to stand up and say, you want to follow Jesus? Here's the deal. Wake up at 6, drink coffee on a porch, head to the graveyard. After that, I want you pumping the Album Leaf on the way back to the office, where once you get there, I want you reading Calvin's Institutes. And then when it's over, say a prayer and go to bed, because we got to do the same thing tomorrow. That's what it looks like to follow Jesus. And that's what most of us have been sold. Somebody else's sync up with God. Michael Bleeker, who leads worship at The Village, wildly different than I am. On any given occasion, you'll catch him in the sanctuary strumming his guitar and singing just the Psalms. He'll just pick a psalm and just sing it to God. And that syncs up his soul with the things of God. It stirs his heart towards Jesus. If I take him to the graveyard or you make me play the guitar, it doesn't produce the same effects. So here's a monumental question for you as you launch out. What stirs your affections for Jesus Christ? Do you even know? Have you paid attention to the results of your pursuits enough to say, this is what stirs my heart towards Jesus? And in the same way, there are things that rob of those affections. And you got to know what those are too, because some of them for me are completely morally neutral. Like, okay, here's, I can't follow sports too closely because I actually start to care. And all of a sudden I'm depressed because my team lost. And that's a pretty dumb place to be. I mean, isn't it? Moping around, what happened to the Cowboys? Just want to punch you in your head, all right? Want to punch me in my head. Well, who cares, all right? It's a freaking game. It's a game. It's men running around, hitting each other, all right? Well, why does this create in me this desire to want to win and want to see and want, so I can't follow it, man. And I know that might sound dumb, but I can't. It robs me of my affections. I get distracted. I've got to watch it. I can't watch too much television. I don't think television is the demon box that's going to destroy your life if you watch too much of it. I just can't. For whatever reason, if I watch it too long, I start laughing at what God calls deplorable. I can't separate it, man. So I got to watch it. I got to be careful. We just watch 24. We just watch Jack Bauer kill people. That's who I want to be when I grow up. I'm not going to lie to you. So television's a thing I've got to limit. And I could go on and on, but I think you're getting my point. What stirs your affections for Jesus Christ? Here's why. Because outside of Jesus, let me read this last line and I'll close and pray. I think I've been teaching for like an hour anyway, so I'm probably in trouble. Look at that last verse again, 26. For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. Now listen to this. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting only to give to one who pleases God. Okay, so if you're sitting here, you're going, so you're telling me that if I don't love Jesus, God's going to take all my stuff and give it to Christians? Yeah, but let me tell you kind of a little way this works. Let me tell you the heart behind it, and then we'll close in prayer. We work in downtown Dallas in a neighborhood that's kind of been depleted. One of the things I teach at The Village is that the suburbia, they have a responsibility to the city. They just do. And God has not given us at The Village this wealth and this money to spend on ourselves. He's given us the resources he's given us so we can push back what's dark in the world. And I don't mean just by that evangelism, because we do because we're saved. We don't do to save. Jesus saves, right? So we don't give a cup of soup to someone so that they'll get saved. We are saved, so we give a cup of soup to someone. Are you tracking with that? Okay. So we've been downtown in a little ghetto area downtown, rebuilding some things and working on transforming. And one of the things that we found down there was this old abandoned mansion. I mean, this just unbelievable 7-bedroom mansion with this unreal crown molding. It's just this beautiful place that got abandoned because as the neighborhood turned south, the wealthy man and woman who built it didn't want to live there anymore and they couldn't sell it, so they just bailed. Well, guess who owns it now? We do. We do. This is one example of this. But let me tell you more of the heart behind this little verse. We find ourselves, if you'll really chase after Jesus, you get these lenses from him to see life at this deeper level. And there's all this beauty and there's all this really amazing stuff all around us that God longs to communicate to us in that people outside of Jesus, they just don't see. So they miss the depth. They miss kind of the ultimate reason, the ultimate reality that's around them. Think Matrix. Like, I'll give you an example. I have a 9-month-old son, Reed, a 3.5-year-old daughter, 9-month-old son. Now, Reed, he doesn't bring anything to the family. I'm just trying to be honest. He poops and he eats, and that's the extent of his existence. He cannot carry on a conversation with us. He can't. He says ba 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 over and over and over again. That's the extent of his language skills right now. All right. So can't carry on a conversation. I can carry on a conversation with my 3.5-year-old. Can't do it with my 9-month-old. He does nothing but eat and poop. He does not bring anything. Doesn't bring home. He doesn't throw $100 on the bar. He doesn't. He just does nothing but mess himself and require an amazing amount of time out of his mother and I. All right? Now, that doesn't bother me. Look at me. It doesn't bother me at all. In fact, right now, right where he is, I am unbelievably in love with him. And I would, there's a great book out there called Conversations with Bono. And one of the things Bono says, he never knew rage and hate until he had children. And then when he would imagine somebody harming his children, there would be rage and hate that swelled up in him. I can find some rhythm there. I get that. And here's why, even though Reed does nothing of value, why it doesn't bother my heart that all he does is make a mess. Because in this really weird way, I can see into the future and I know he won't always just be pooping his pants. Tracking with me? That there's coming a day where he does talk, he does give, he does bring joy through conversation and life. And as I was changing a diaper one day, I started thinking, man, this is eerily similar to God's relationship with me. That all I tend to do is make messes and yet he's still so wildly in love with me. Look at me. Not some future version of me. Me. The rest of the world changes a diaper. Those who belong to the kingdom see the deeper reality. Or like, I love dinner. Like, not the thing you had in your car on the way out here. I like having my friends over and cooking together. Like, everybody will get, like, one group does the salad, one group, and we get there and we bring all the ingredients and we make it and we open a bottle of Dr. Pepper and we we grill it out and then what we do is that we eat and we drink and we laugh and we tell stories, and there's something very, 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 very holy and right and good in that. And outside the kingdom is just dinner. This is what he means here at the end. That those who will pursue what stirs their affections and starve out what robs them affections will find dinner becoming more than dinner. Friendships becoming more than friendships. Money becoming just money. Stuff becoming just stuff. Freedom. Let's pray. Father, I thank you for these men and women, and I pray that some of the things spoken this morning would be haunting. I think that's my prayer. Haunt, haunt, haunt. I pray that these things wouldn't just be heard and intellectually grabbed. Pray that this little passage of Ecclesiastes wouldn't be discussed over coffee in a mere intellectual way, but instead, Father, would penetrate the deepest parts of us. Pray today that specifically on the what stirs your affections and what robs you of affections, that we might really begin to wrestle through that. Maybe get a journal and get a Bible and go for a walk, or put on our iPod and listen to some music and try to figure out what really does stir our affections. And I pray for my brothers and sisters in here who have found, like, over the last year or two, their faith has become increasingly intellectual and you feel far from them. I pray that maybe something that was said or something that was spoken might begin to rekindle that romance, that desire to know you deeply and intimately. I thank you for Hosea chapter 2, where you say that out in the desert we'll learn to call you husband instead of master. I pray that you'd stretch us. And I pray that if we're sabotaging relationships because we're expecting our girlfriends or our boyfriends or our friends or our job or our stuff to bring lasting fulfillment, and it's not, so we've been attacking and starting fights and creating conflicts because, I pray that you would reveal that to us. I thank you for Watermark Church that has programs like Celebrate Recovery and other places like that where we can go and find some help wading through our junk. And I thank you for a place like Watermark where it's okay to not be okay. So I pray that you'd help us not pretend, and that you would help us be sincere and authentic and real before you. And I thank you for Gomer, and I thank you for the woman at the well, and I thank you for Nicodemus and Peter and all the men and women in Scripture who prove that when we fail, you still love. So help us. I think our hearts cry is that we want to love you more than we do, and we're finding that difficult. It's for your beautiful name I prayed these things. Amen.